Hello, friends. Kyle Tierman here, and welcome to another episode of my podcast. We have a brand new sponsor for the show, and I am very excited to talk about them right now. Claude Copywriting Agency writes the best marketing emails in the world. You know how marketing emails generally suck? Well, what if they didn't have to? Claude Agency writes emails that imbue your brand story in every single email. These are emails that surprise and delight and move your customers so that they become stoked about who you are and what you stand for in the world before the product even shows up on their doorstep. Because here's the deal. Most marketing emails sound like they were written by ChatGPT, okay? They're grabby. They're weird. And what happens is that all these brands basically get caught in the same race to the bottom, where they're just like, we need to send more emails, bigger discounts, more exclamation points. And then they wonder why their open rates suck and their customers hate them, okay? This is a really important thing. But most brands don't give it the kind of time and thought that they really should, because every email that you send as a brand is a miniature commercial, okay? So let's put that same kind of thought into your marketing emails so that they can really move your customers to become brand loyal. So how do I know that these emails are great? Well, because Claude Agency is my copywriting agency. That's right. Over the last 6 months, I've been developing this agency that specializes in pre- and post-purchase email flows. Okay? And the way that I got the idea for this was because when I was working at Mudwater as their copywriter, we put a lot of thought into what our emails sounded like. And as a result, we maintained really high open rates. So that then when we had a new product launch or something like that, people actually wanted to hear from us. They wanted to open our emails. And this, it's like a kind of fertilizer that allows your whole marketing garden to grow. So in 2024, don't skimp out on your marketing emails. Make sure that they're something that you are proud of. So hit me up directly. My email is kyle@claude.agency. And maybe we can work something out. I would love to help you as a founder tell your story right and get your customers stoked about what you're doing. That's claude.agency. We are an out-of-the-box way to inbox. All right. This podcast is with Lee Povey. I met Lee back when I was working with Mudwater. And Lee is the CEO and founder of Maximize Your Potential Coaching, as well as the co-founder of Coaches Soul. As a previous elite cycling athlete and Olympic development program coach for USA Cycling, and from coaching hundreds of world, national, and Olympic champions, Lee understands the importance of world-class leadership. Lee's mission as a leadership coach is to empower and support leaders, executives, and elite coaches in achieving their leadership and life goal potential. So, one thing that I think Mudwater and Shane Heath, who's the CEO of that company, who's been a guest on this podcast many times, did really smart is they invested in their employees' mental health. And one thing that I noticed while I was working there is that Lee and his team, being on hand to help all the Mudwater employees, really served to support that culture of positive mental health, of being able to talk about what you're going through, of having someone who's in a third-party position be able to listen as you talk about maybe employee dynamics or problems that you're facing and help guide you through it. I felt like it was just an amazing investment that Mudwater made and really showed a lot of, honestly, Shane's character to invest that kind of money and resources into having Lee and his team come into Mud. And Lee and I have stayed in touch, so I asked if he would come on the podcast because some of the concepts that I learned while we were working together have really stuck with me. So if you also are a business owner and you want to reach out to Lee and his team, I believe that they are open for business and his contact will be in the episode notes. All right. This is a great conversation. Lee is a very sharp dude, very clear thinker, and I just had a blast. Hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Please welcome to the podcast, Lee Povey.
Kyle Tamron here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
It's not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of El Mali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
And away we go. Okay. Lee Pavi, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. It's been a long time coming.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, yes. So what's going on in your world right now? What's on your mind? What are the major challenges that you're facing in your world? You're usually the guy who helps people face other people face their challenges. What are the big hurdles that you're coming at right now?
So that's how we're starting, is it? We're going straight in, no messing around.
I want to
no
know.
Warming me up.
No warming. Well, I want to know. Here, let's start here. I want to know what a tyrannical Einstein is, because I've had a really good laugh about this ever since I learned that term from you, and maybe that's a good jumping off point.
Okay, so to people listen to this. Me and Kyle have obviously spoken offline a little bit, and tyrannical Einstein is a name for a part of my personality that myself and a couple of coaches that I've worked with came up with. And to kind of go behind it a little bit to explain the process and why this is so useful, all of us are born with certain genetic personality traits. So we come into the world and we just have certain ways that we will be and ways that our brain works and we're going to behave. And when I was younger, I used to think that everything was what we learned, that we were completely moldable, came out of the womb, and it was all to do with our upbringing. And having watched my mum and my auntie foster over 100 high-risk kids over a 10-year period, and then dedicating the last 15, 20 years of my life to understanding psychology, I realized actually probably slightly more than 50% of it is genetic, and then the other 50% is what we've learned. So we come out of the womb with these genetic personality traits. With my coaches, I've established mine as brilliance, play, vision, connection, and presence. So I'm smart, I'm playful, I'm able to see the big picture. I love being in connection, and I spend a lot of my life creating connections and making sure I maintain those connections. And, you'll know this, Carl, when you're in conversation with me, I am very present. I am there and aware of what's going on, and I don't drift off. You have my attention. And, you know, I also have some presence. I'm fairly big, very sporty. I walk into a room, people notice me, and that has its ups and downs. And then you enter the world and the world meets you. And the first part of the world that meets you is your family system. So you get immediate feedback from your family system. So, you know, if you're smart, you're going to get some feedback on that. And that feedback might be good. And people might say to you, oh, you're so smart. That's so good. And you might even then build your personality even more around it. Or you might get feedback of, you're too smart. Stop being so cocky. Shut up. Stop asking so many questions. And what happens from that is we then take on these kind of adaptive behaviors to survive in our family system, to fit in. Ultimately, we all just want to be loved. So what do? We try to adapt ourselves to get that love. Now, you know, my family system, I had a very loving mum, and then I had a not at all loving father. My father is very narcissistic, most likely a sociopath, and didn't have the ability to empathize with others or really understand others. Everything was an extension of him. And how I was an extension of him was purely on my sporting ability. So his favorite sport was cycling. So guess what sport Lee ended up doing? And how I adapted to not get what I needed from him was to take on a leadership role very early in the family. And my adaptation of that was to be a tyrant. So if I ever felt out of control, if I felt scared, if I felt threatened, I would make sure that I controlled everything around me, and I would do that with my intelligence. So that's why it's tyrannical Einstein. And it's also, if you know about Einstein, he was incredibly kind. So there is still some kindness to it of, there's that part of me that comes with a lot of love and a lot of kindness. But that shield that I took on was just to be smarter than everybody else and to take lots of control. So I have lots of control for myself, but I would also control other people. I'd also place myself above other people. So, if I was feeling threatened, I would put you down to make myself feel safe.
Right. And what I'm hearing from that also is that part of you would come out most often when you felt threatened. So if there was any response, fight, flight, freeze, or fawn, you would very comfortably be confrontational. That's one thing that I get from you. Like you're very happy to meet a situation head on and confront it. That's probably the athlete in you. And when you feel threatened, that part of you would even ramp up more. So one thing that, I've really gotten a lot of benefit from you out of is learning that we all have our own ways of dealing with things when we get out of control. And if we are in a really comfortable situation on a beach in Hawaii, most everyone hopefully can be pretty nice to be around. But if we're in, let's say, a high-stakes startup environment where we're dealing with a lot of different personalities, a lot of deadlines, a lot of pressure, these parts of ourselves that we're maybe not so proud of rear their heads in very ugly ways in very high-stakes moments. So one thing that you do is help people identify how those parts of ourselves do come out and how to respond rather than react. Is that all correct?
Yeah, I love that. And I love how you framed it. And you're talking about like that, survival system of the fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. So if we look at the function of our brain, we have the limbic system, and that is our emotional response to things. And there's a thought, you see this a lot with influencers where they kind of pretend that doesn't happen. And you should either just be like super positive or you should be cool the whole time and never let anything affect you. And that's just ignoring human psychology and evolutionary biology. Yeah.
How I became happy and stayed there.
Yes. So, there's we're always going to have a response for everything at all times. And that response might be a microsecond or it might be a week. And my work and where I want to be of use to the world, and I really mean that, I don't mean that in a patronizing way, like I really want to be of use to the world, is helping people understand that it's completely normal to have those responses and then to be able to move past those responses and choose how we would like to be instead. So we're moving from the limbic system to our prefrontal cortex. So we're making now conscious choices. You might also call this the executive system. And we're moving from reaction to thought conscious choices. And until you get taught this stuff, until you get this stuff exposed to you, it sounds obvious, but it's not as obvious as it really turns out to be. And a big part of it is you must understand yourself and what activates you. People talk about getting triggered, and being triggered, I think, is actually a little bit different. I like the word activated because my survival system is activated. That tyrant is activated. And that tends to come in two situations. One, where we feel unsure, unsafe, unseen, unloved, or when somebody else is in there. Activated state that's likely to bring us out. That's why when you're having that argument with your romantic partner and you're both talking to each other, you're getting angry and nothing really is being discussed, and you've missed the point and you're missing each other, and you end your discussion and you think, what the hell happened there? Like, what was that even about? Yeah. Why are we arguing? Yeah,
I remember we were fighting but don't know what it was about.
Yeah. And basically, you've just become these two animals that are reacting to each other. And I've got this lovely dog I go to the dog park and I get to see her in that state often. You know, a new dog comes up and you see her react. Like, is this dog a threat? Is this dog a friend? What do I do? Do I get aggressive and get bigger? Do I run away? Do I just freeze? And you see all of this happen in a lifetime. Well, humans are the same, but what we've got is we've got a prefrontal cortex. So we actually have choice once we know how to use that effectively.
Right. Yeah. I was talking to a friend once. His name's Chris Ryan. He's a real smart guy, kind of big thinker. And we were talking about how history repeats itself. And he had a great line. He said, history repeats itself, but every time the stakes get higher. And I think that it's the same for a human life, where if you are a toddler and you freak out because something activates you, the stakes aren't very high because you don't have a whole lot of control or power. But if you are the CEO of a fast growing startup, by you having a tantrum, that could cost millions of dollars. It could cost your best performing employees. It could cost you a lot. The stakes get higher and higher as we move into positions of more and more power. So the work that you do becomes that much more important. And being able to recognize those feelings in your body and not just react, you know, it's a journey, and it just continues to, the stakes continue to rise year after year as we kind of hurl through Earth.
I love that. That's a great observation, Kyle. And, you know, the higher up the tree of leadership you go, the more people you're likely to impact. And that impact can be positive. You can be a mentor to them. You can inspire them. You can change them for the better. Or it can be a negative. And you can be stuck in your stuff and you can be reacting and everybody is just trying to scrabble around and survive. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of brilliant people that can go pretty far because they're so smart and their ideas have so much value, yet still causing lots of harm, either to individuals or to companies or, you know, frankly, to the planet. You know, we have companies now that have a direct impact on the planet. And if the leaders of those companies are stuck in their survival systems and not aware of their impact, that has an impact on the whole of humanity.
Mm-hmm. So when you, I want you to walk me through working with a startup. So what are some of the questions that you might ask a CEO or a leadership team in one of those initial meetings, and what do you, you know, hope that you can offer a team like this who might be in this situation? You know, because, you know, for a lot of people who maybe don't work at a startup or you know, in they're inside a company like this, what are some of those problems that they're facing? Kind of just paint that picture for me.
Yeah, love that. You know, the companies that I tend to work with, and I think it's worth establishing that first, tend to have already discovered or have something useful that they're adding to the world. So they have a decent product or service or idea. And where I tend to be very useful to them is helping them grow rapidly. So that requires human beings. That requires a team, and that requires a team that can work together. So often what you find with the CEOs is it's a big challenge from going from being the smartest person in most rooms that you walk into and being incredibly driven and probably, you know, happy to work or capable of working 80 hours a week to then suddenly going, well, how do I do that with 20 people? And then how do I do that with 50 people? And then how do I do that with 100 people? And each one of those stages, your leadership has to adapt a little bit. And you can't be the same person you were when there was three of you, when there's 20 of you, and then when there's 50 of you. And you can't have the same impact on the company. You have to rely on more people. And that is one of the hardest things for the smartest people in the room to deal with is, how do I rely on somebody else? How do I rely on somebody else? How do I let somebody else make the mistakes that they need to make so that they can grow and they can learn and they can get resilient and they can understand this company? And how do I trust that even if their approach might be different from mine, it's okay? And that's when I'm working individually with founders, that could be some of the hardest stuff. And we go back to what we started this conversation with. If you're not aware of what activates you and how you behave when you're activated, that's just going to leak out everywhere. So understanding yourself as a leader and as a human being is the first part of anything. So who am I? Where am I now? And then the next part of the coaching is, where do you want to get? Right? Are you looking to be acquired? Are you looking to build this into to whatever you want to build it into? Do you want to make this into a $1 billion company? Do you want to go public? Having an idea of some of that. And then also, what do you think it's going to take from you to do that? Like, how are you going to need to change and adapt as a leader to be able to do that? Whether that be you developing the skills that you need to develop and the self-awareness you need to develop, whether that be who else might I need to bring on? How might my role as a founder change? Will I still be the CEO? Will I not be the CEO? Do I bring somebody else on to do that? And there's a lot of ego in that. And it, you know, that's where it helps to have somebody who's going to sit there and not judge you and be able to reflect, hey, how's your ego showing up right now? How is your activation system showing up right now? And what would you like to do instead, and keep reflecting that to you? And then really we coach the gap in between. So who are you now? Where are you now? And where would you like to get to? And then where I think I'm a bit different from some other coaches is I seem to be really good at doing that for a whole company as well. I've discovered I've got a gift for talking to lots of different people at a company without sharing each people's stuff with each other.
I would imagine that wouldn't be helpful. Well, what I heard from the CEO privately about you is...
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and that's harder than you think.
Right.
Because you're carrying all these things in your brain. So it's not even just how do I just not share something that I've been told, but how do I not even act like I know that?
Right.
So how do I not steer this conversation with this information that I know? And instead, how do I do what's best for this individual in front of me? And doing what's best for this individual in front of me will always support the company. And what we can do, though, and this is what I really enjoy doing, is by knowing all of the different players in the company or the major players in the company, I can coach people on how they need to approach that person. And this is where I've seen a lot of success in the startups that I work with, is I coach people on how to work with both the team and the uniqueness of the team, and then the individual players in the team. So like, how are you more likely to have success taking this to the CEO in the team or to the CFO? Like, how are you going to connect with that person? And then something else I really like doing with these teams is we get everybody together and then we have group calls. Mm. So I tend to work with the executive team and the director teams. And, you know, one, it just creates this massive sense of camaraderie. The team comes together and we do things like clearings. And you know, if you've never seen one of these, they're pretty fraught. You know, somebody will come to the team and say, someone else in the team, you've really pissed me off. And when you did this, it really upset me. And this is how I feel now. And what we do is we coach that in a moment in front of each other to then be able to create repair. And when we do that, what happens, instead of people building resentments with each other and frustrations with each other, they actually build compassion for each other. And their ability to connect and work together gets elevated. It also empowers them to be able to call each other out, because they can call each other out knowing that I'm in the room to moderate. And if things go awry, I'm going to be able to keep it on course and make sure that we do end up in repair rather than ending up in rupture.
Right, right. Yeah. When you start working at a company, it's like everyone has this secret syllabus to themselves, but no one has shared it. You know, so like if you do best with really direct communication because you grew up in New York, and if I tell you you're being a fucker, it just means that I like you and I'm in direct communication. But if you grew up in Topanga, California, and you prefer just rose petals being draped all over you before any piece of feedback, you're going to receive the information completely differently. So what I'm hearing that you do is helping people get into a position where they can even give or receive any kind of feedback effectively, so that they can actually hear each other and hopefully move forward to some common solution. We just assume that people will be able to hear us because we are saying something. But so often there's like miles of gunk and shit in the way between what we just said and them being able to hear it and incorporate it and move forward with it.
Yeah, I've always admired your perceptiveness, Kyle. You know, I go back to what we said at the beginning. We're all just kids that want to be loved. Mm-hmm. And then stuff gets in the way of that. And part of that is how we communicate to others and how we receive information and how we, especially how we receive feedback. Mm. A common thing for me, I go into a startup and everybody says to me, I would like more feedback. Now, they aren't necessarily prepared for how they're going to receive it. And they absolutely are not prepared to give it. So, you know, I go in, people are saying, I need more feedback. I need more feedback on how I'm doing. And I want to be better. And I want this to work. And I want this to work. And I'm really passionate. And I love the founder. And oh, I love everything. Like, great. How do you receive feedback? And then are you prepared to give feedback at the level that you would like to receive it? And there's a big skill to giving feedback. You know, I run workshops on giving feedback. And there's absolutely techniques to giving feedback. And then there's ownership yourself of how am I likely to react to feedback? And we all react differently. You know, I'm like you, I'm British. The culture in the UK is to be much more teasing, much more direct around feedback. And there's a more community aspect of if there's bad behavior, the community will call it out. And my experience in America is, you know, some areas are different. New York might be one. On the whole, my experience in America is people are less direct and less likely to call out bad behavior. You know, one of the advantages of that is people really believe in themselves. One of the disadvantages is you don't get people reflecting to you your gain areas. You know, this is why people employ me. What you're going to get with me is one of my gifts is I'm going to tell you what you can't see about yourself. Now, I can get away with it because I'll bring humor to it and I'll bring a lot of love to it. And those two things I've had to work hard on because I've always been very good at pointing out what you can't see about yourself and the gain areas. I haven't always been so good at doing it in such a way the other person can hear it. You know, the reason why I give lectures and why I give workshops on giving feedback is because I was so fucking terrible at it, Kyle. I was awful. You know, when I first started as a cycling coach, I'd go up to people, I'd see them in a velodrome doing something. So for those that don't know, track cycling, a velodrome is an indoor bank, 250 meter wooden track. And that was where most of my work would take place. So I'd go up to somebody and say, hey, why are you doing it like this? Why don't you do it like this instead? Because you'll go so much faster. And it was coming from a place of love, as in, I genuinely want people to be better. Like, that's just the way I'm built. I love seeing people be the best versions of themselves. But guess how people receive that message when I come up to them and say, you're doing it all wrong. They get defensive, they feel shame, they feel belittled, they feel small, and they are not able to hear the message.
And they probably are
so
just
learn.
They're probably just looking to find ways to point holes in your game then too.
Exactly. Right. You know, they're looking at me and they either get reactive with like, well, you're not so great.
Yeah.
Maybe true. I still have information to offer you. Or they just get very defensive and get shut down and they can't hear it. So, you know, I learned you've got to build rapport with people and you've got to ask permission. Like, this is one of the biggest things that people don't do with giving feedback. They don't ask permission. And then you've got to ask what the other person understands. Hey, I saw you doing this, you know, I saw you doing this exercise. How did it go for you? And great. May I give you some feedback? And I think I've seen something that you might like. Is a completely different approach to, hey, why did you do it like that? That's rubbish. Why don't you do it like this instead? Mm. And the information I'm going to give you after that is exactly the same. But how you set it up, how you get buy-in, how you create rapport completely change how the message will be received by the other party.
Right, right. Yeah, you're warming up before you hit the sprint. So give me, I would love to just do a quick script with you around giving and receiving feedback. And there's a lot of other things I want to talk to you about, but it seems like this is just so, it's such a common place where relationships become fraught or they become closer. And it's so necessary for any kind of growth to happen. And it's just so common that we are blind to our own selves. And it just seems like such a worthwhile skill to burn a few more calories on. So I would love to just hear, you know, how would you teach a group of people how to give and receive feedback, just and even real, like, down to the sentence levels that you've found work to open up that willingness to listen.
Yeah, love that. I think the first thing is just to take a step back and think, what are we looking to achieve with this when we're giving feedback? Am I giving you feedback because I want to look smart? Am I giving you feedback because I want to be right? Or, you know, as one of my coaches, Kari, that you've met, put it, am I giving feedback to be effective, to help you be effective? So coming from question yourself first, what am I giving this feedback for? What am I trying to achieve here? Checking in with yourself. And if you're clear, this is to be a, help the other person be effective and to help the whole team be effective, if we're talking about in a work situation, that's a good starting point. Secondly, don't give any feedback you wouldn't be prepared to hear yourself.
Mm.
So if you're not prepared to receive feedback, don't give feedback, because nobody's going to want to work with a person that only ever gives feedback. And, you know, when we're thinking about feedback, feedback can land in a lot of different ways, and there's a lots of different aspects to it. You know, one of it is there's positive feedback, and then the other one, what people would typically call negative feedback or critical feedback, I like to call it opportunity feedback, because I think that's where it should come from. I'm giving you an opportunity. You may choose to take it or not. Here's something I can offer to you that's going to make your world or the company be better. And what we see about the best leaders is, best leaders are, that they give that kind of positive, encouraging, acknowledging feedback in similar amounts to they give the opportunity and growth-oriented feedback. And, you know, the model I like to use, I think you've heard this before, is I like to think of it as a cookie jar. So you have this cookie jar filled with lovely, big, fat cookies. Every time somebody every time somebody gives you observational feedback, they're reaching into your cookie jar and they're taking some out, because it takes some energy to receive that feedback. Every time somebody praises you, acknowledges you, reinforces what you're doing well, they're sticking the cookies back in the jar. Now, if you are going around only ever giving observational feedback, everybody around you, eventually their jar becomes empty. And when somebody's jar is empty, there is no room to give them more feedback. So if you've ever experienced, I just can't talk to this person, if ever I give them feedback, they just get so defensive, I would question, have you ever given them anything good about themselves? Have you ever given anything that fills their bucket,
right,
that fills their cookie jar up? So before we even think about feedback itself, we've got to think about what kind of feedback are we giving. And then when we give him feedback, you know, as I said, one of the first things I like to do is encourage people to ask for permission. And when I first do this with people, it feels really clunky and they're like, oh, this is so weird. Yeah, something changes when you say to somebody, Kyle, do you mind if I give you some feedback? Or Kyle, I've seen something I think might be interesting to you. Do you mind me sharing it with you? When you say yes, there is just a change in your psychology as to how you are going to receive the feedback. You're like, okay, I am ready. There's a change in your state, rather than somebody just jumping in and saying, hey, here's what you're doing.
Mm. Can I just for a moment, would you recommend that if you're someone who's giving feedback, you'd say something like, hey, would you be open to a piece of feedback? Or is there another time that you'd be more willing to hear it? Because it feels like to say, are you open to hearing a piece of feedback? It would be hard to say no, you know, because you're like, I don't want to hear it. Whereas if you gave a separate option of like, is now a good time, or is there maybe another time, that could also be helpful. Would you recommend that someone maybe phrase it that way?
Yeah, I kind of separate those out, and set in makes a big difference when we're giving feedback.
Sure.
So that's, you know, that's the other thing, going back to, do I want to be effective? Well, say you notice something in a group call or in a meeting that somebody's done. Is that the best time to give them feedback? Most people don't appreciate being given any kind of opportunity or gain feedback in front of other people.
Right.
You find it shaming, belittling, you know, even if it's done skillfully and the message is right and it's useful, most people would prefer to hear it one-on-one.
Right.
So thinking of when you're going to give the feedback is vital.
Right. I once heard praise in public, criticize in private.
Absolutely. You know, if I just think, and also, you know, the emotional state of that person. If somebody's just done a presentation and it went really poorly, do you think they're going to be open to feedback the moment they step off the stage and walk out of the room?
Yeah.
Absolutely not. You know, it'd be exactly the same in, you know, my previous world of elite sports where, you know, somebody's gone and done a race, they've messed the race up, they come off the velodrome. That is not the time for me to give them feedback that's going to be in any way effective. They're likely to be angry with themselves or feeling some shame and disappointment. And we just don't receive information very well when we're in, to go back to the earlier part of the discussion, that emotional state, that below the line emotional state. So thinking when you're going to give the feedback is, I love that you asked that, is a really important part of it. So kind of to separate that out from the script itself, when the time is right, think about, is this the right time to give the feedback? You know, are they in a mood where they're going to receive the feedback? And be clear with somebody, you can say no. And have a culture in the company that if you're not ready for feedback, you get to say no. In my experience, most of the time, if you have a good working relationship and rapport with people, 99% of the time, they're not going to say no. However, it's still worth asking because one, it shows that you care and you're checking in. And two, there is that shift when somebody says yes.
Mm.
And, you know, we must acknowledge, what do you do when somebody says no to receiving feedback? You respect it. The only time you don't respect it is if it's mission critical. If it's like, okay, I have to give you this feedback right now, you know, somebody's doing something dangerous on the velodrome, I've got to give them feedback in a moment, even if it's in front of other people, even if it, you know, they might feel some shame. I've got to protect their physical well-being. You know, if somebody's about to do something really stupid for a company and, you know, make a really bad call, I've got to give them feedback in a moment. And that is when, as a leader, you know to make those decisions. Mm. Most of the time, feedback isn't critical that it's given in that very moment.
Right, right. So I love the idea of someone who gives a shitty presentation, because I work at a creative agency now, and yeah. Really all we're doing is pitching all the time. Just ideas. Get on the client, call the client, give a pitch, get them excited. Great, you want to buy the commercial? Let's do it. So if someone gives a shitty presentation, that is a big deal because you might lose the client. How would you recommend, let's say I go on, I'm the one giving the presentation and I totally blow it. I go too long. I am not charismatic. I get way too detail oriented in this one section of the presentation, and everyone else on the call can feel the client losing interest, kind of drifting off. Meanwhile, I'm just getting so into the font size that we're using, and then the call goes 15 minutes over plan, and then and then the client gets off the call, and I'm like, "All right, everyone, you're welcome, Kyle, in rare form, huh? All right, see you boys Monday, woo!" So, what would you write? Let's say that I'm the copywriter, you're the creative director. I thought it went really well, and you're horrified. Give me that feedback, and let's go through that script.
So the first thing I have to do as a creative director is acknowledge my emotional response to it. Okay, I'm angry or I'm disappointed or I'm sad, you know, whatever emotional response I'm having, note that and go, it's not about me. It's about being effective. It's not about being right in the moment. It's about being effective. So my approach would be, hey, Kyle, how do you think that went?
I felt like it went pretty well. You know, it seemed like you know, there were some ideas that they really enjoyed. And I'm really stoked on how I delivered that. You know, maybe it went a little long, but no, I'm feeling good.
Cool. I agree. I thought there was good energy in the room. I felt that you had good engagement at parts during the call. I'm curious what you would do differently next time. If you're looking to really maximize it, how would you change it next time?
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, there were some slow parts towards the middle, but I don't know. Like, what do you think?
I'm curious what you think first. How would you do it differently?
Well, I think that I could have potentially thought more about how I wanted to end the presentation so I didn't flounder towards the last bit. And I think that I probably spent a little too much time talking about the difference between Helvetica and Times New Roman. Given that this is a video commercial and text doesn't really have anything to do with it, yeah, maybe I probably didn't need to spend a good half hour on text and fonts.
Love that. How will you do that differently next time?
Well, given that it's a video commercial, I guess I don't even need to talk about fonts.
Great. Love that observation. And I've got a couple of things I'd like to share with you if you're open to it that I think will make you more effective.
Yeah, I would love that.
Cool. I think a little bit more preparation beforehand so that you limit the amount of time you spend in specific areas will help you finish on time. And I'd encourage you to look at around the room when you're giving your presentation and look for the clues as to how involved the people are and how engaged they are. And something I find works really well with that is just checking in with them. What are you taking from this at the moment? What are you thinking? What are you feeling? And that gets more engagement from your audience and that gives you the immediate feedback. So if things aren't going quite how you want, you can adjust them easier in the room.
Okay. That's super helpful. I hadn't thought of that.
Great. Let's do it next time and let's see how it goes.
Boom. Okay. So here's this, that little moment right there. I loved how quickly you found the exit to finish it up. I find that during uncomfortable conversations, it's really common to prepare what you're going to say, right? Because, okay, this is how I'm going to give the feedback. And then after you give the feedback, you almost backtrack because you're afraid that you've hurt the person's feelings. And then you go on this, like, parade of compliments and, like, verbal salad of just like weird, like, hey, we're still friends, right? Like without being able to sit in what should be an uncomfortable moment. Because if you're my superior, I should probably get fired if I do that once or twice more, right? So how do you, like, I felt like you gave that feedback very well and then finished it up and left. How would you recommend people, I suppose, finish those conversations, letting the person know that there's a seriousness to this, but also you don't want to make them now live in fear and create a culture of fear? Are there any specific techniques to that, to stomping the landing of feedback?
Yeah, love that. I think we need to separate out a couple of things here. So the first is culture. So maybe we'll come back, like put a pin in it and talk about culture separately. And then something else to separate out is the difference between being a friend with people that you work with and being a leader and how we kind of work on that too. I think often when people are giving feedback, they, as you say, they have this preparation. Like, this is how this must go. Never goes like that. So let go of that first away. Have the bullets that you would like in an ideal call to get across. While remembering, really, people can only take on one or two bits of feedback at a time.
Okay.
If somebody leaves a feedback session with one really clear bit of feedback that they can action next time, that's a successful session.
You know, I would see this all the time, especially with sports coaches, interestingly, where they would give like 10 bits of feedback to somebody and that person just cannot process it. And now they're completely lost and they're going backwards. So one or two bits of feedback at most at one time. Remember that you want to also look for what they're doing well, because usually there is something they're doing well, you know, and it's not always rubbish. So look for what they're doing well, reinforce that too. And not from a place of, I want them to like me. So this is another thing that you highlighted there is, oh, I've got to repair this. And oh, I've got to make sure that you're okay. It's okay for people to have feelings about feedback. It's okay for somebody to walk out of the room and be pissed off that they just got told they didn't do it as well as they thought they did. You, as the person given the feedback, are not responsible for the other person's reactions or their feelings. What you're responsible for is how you deliver it.
Mm.
And that's it. And, you know, we can really elevate this up to leadership in its whole, which is you are not responsible for how somebody else reacts. You are responsible for your impact and how you go about it. How somebody chooses to react to that impact, that is on them, and you cannot be responsible for it. You know, give an example. We're walking down the road. Somebody comes up to us and says, you're an arsehole, out of the blue. And I laugh, and you punch the person. And we've had a completely different reaction to the same thing. So we're going to get these stimuli to us all the time. And then what we are in control of is how we react. And then you have to trust that other people are going to do the same thing. And they've got to have their process, whatever it may be. And, you know, we kind of missed it earlier, but to add on to delivering feedback, some people prefer feedback face to face. Some people prefer feedback in writing first so they can think about it, be prepared and come back. I'm really sharp on my feet. So I like feedback directly in the moment, face to face. I'm usually not going to take it personally. So you can be pretty blunt with me. And I just want to, I have an ethos of, I just want to always improve. And not everybody's like that. So as leaders, you've got to learn what's the most effective way to deal with this person themselves while trusting they're going to be okay. And I don't have to fix everything at every moment. It's okay for people to feel discomfort. And then we come to the culture part of it, which is acknowledging all of that in the first place and having a culture in the company that we debrief things after they happen. So when I was coaching the Olympic development program, I set up very early with the athletes, we would always debrief. So after every exercise, there'd be a debrief. After every training session, there'd be a debrief. At various periods in the year, there'd be debriefs. So this set up from the beginning, that's a culture. We investigate things, we talk about it, we are looking for ways to be more effective. Now, if you come into a company that has no culture of that, you've got to work on the culture first. Because if you come in really hot and heavy and you're doing this wrong and you're doing that wrong and you're doing that wrong, everybody's going to get freaked out. You've got to invite people in. You've got to sell, hey, this is what we're going to do now and this is why we're going to do it and this is how we're going to work. I do find, though, that in most organizations, people want feedback. So it's not that there's not a desire for it usually. It's just about how we do it. Mm. And as you say, you know, I do these practice labs with people. So I do the workshop and then we do a practice lab. And the practice lab is pairs taking 5 minutes to give each other feedback. And the first time I do the practice lab, there is all of this fluff. Like, hey, oh, good to see you. Oh, I really love you, man. And I love what you do. And you're such a vital part of our team. By the third or fourth time we're doing it, it's, hey, how you doing? May I give you some feedback? This is what I saw. This is what I'd like to see differently. What are you taking away from this? Let's agree on an action point. Bang, done. And it's just much more direct, hit in, move on.
Mm. Let's talk about external validation. I find that most people feel that they're not appreciated enough. I have worked at a place, a few places, but like there's an example of a brand that used this system called High Fives, where it's basically like a really easy way to tag someone and give them props throughout the week. So it's like, hey, I saw that you were doing this nice thing, and you log into your email, and every day you have a few high fives from other employees. And I remember it felt really good to get this, right? Because you just feel like constantly like there's this validation of, hey, people see me and what I'm doing. And what I noticed is that it very quickly became this thing where I, and it was because of the system, right? It says like you've received 8 high fives and you've given 3 high fives, where then all of a sudden I felt like, okay, I need to be spending more and more of my time giving other team members props. And then what happened when I left the company was I felt this huge dearth of validation that I was getting on a weekly basis to prop my ego up day after day. And after I reflected, I was like, I don't actually think that that's a very healthy culture, because it makes people feel like they're not okay unless they're constantly getting external validation. In my mind, one of the most durable forms of self is where you deeply know that you're okay, and any other validation on top of that is just a cherry on top, right? And I think that it's not just, you know, with this brand, but it's just it culture in general, due to social media, has forced millennials and Gen Zers to feel like we're not fundamentally okay unless we're getting 10 people a day telling us that we are. So first, I just want to get your thoughts on this kind of issue in culture generally, and how you might recommend people develop a more durable sense of self-worth so they can continue to perform with or without that external validation.
Yeah, that's a big question. Firstly, I think culturally, and I'll, you know, again, I can speak to the difference between the UK and America, for example. There seems to be more of a culture here, and there is also in the UK with younger people, that their parents didn't get much in the way of positive encouragement, didn't get much in the way of acknowledgement.
Right.
So they've overreacted.
Right. Because their parents grew up in the Great Depression and were like, yeah, we kept you alive. That's good exactly. enough.
Right. And they didn't understand the psychology of how important it is to give people appreciation. Right. Mm-hmm. It was literally we survive.
Yeah.
And that's it. And now, as our understanding of psychology evolved, parenting changed. And one of those things was tell your kids they're great the whole time. And there's some value to that. However, it has to be specific. And this goes with all feedback. Feedback should be specific. It should be measurable. It should be actionable. That goes for positive feedback too. That goes for appreciation, acknowledgement. And I think there's three levels of that. So you have a compliment. You know, Kyle, you're a good looking bloke, right? That's a compliment. Kyle, you're a good looking bloke. And I've noticed when you smile, it makes other people smile. That's an appreciation. And then there's Kyle, you're a good looking bloke. And I noticed that when you smile, that brings other people into the room. And what I feel is that you do that deliberately because you like bringing other people into the room and you like creating community. And that's the person you are. And I love that about you. That's an acknowledgement. So you've got three different levels there of how we can relate to somebody and how we can appreciate them, how we can acknowledge them, how we can see them for their very being. So if you want to be effective as a leader and as a human being, make most of those acknowledgements and try to minimize the compliments and the appreciations. And I'm not saying you shouldn't do them, because I think it's perfectly fine to say to somebody, I love your sneakers. However, if you can say, I love your sneakers, and I love the joy that those sneakers bring me, and that, you know, you wear really bright sneakers and that just makes me smile, that's a whole nother level. And people will remember those for the rest of their life. So I think we have a culture of good job. So we have a culture, just like you said, a little bit of, there's an expectation that we must be saying nice things, but those nice things are not specific enough that they really actually have an impact. I would rather hear one thing that really relates to who I am as a human being and what I bring to the world than 10 things or 20 things that say, good job, Lee. Like, good job on what? Can you be specific? What was it I did that was good, and why was it good, and what was the impact that it created? So I think, you know, my offering to society is we do need external validation. Like, if you think you're going to get to a point where you can exist without that and be happy, you may. My experience is 99% of humans aren't going to get to that point. So we have to acknowledge that we need some outside love, and that's what community is. And then if we're going to do that, we ought to bring into the world what we want to receive, which is, let's start giving appreciation and acknowledgement rather than compliments or platitudes. It's going to be way more impactful. And I might give you an acknowledgement once every 2 weeks, but you remember those, you know, 20 acknowledgements I gave you in a year, and not the 50 well done Kyles that somebody else gave you.
Right.
So be really effective with that. And it's the same with the gain opportunity and the, you know, the feedback about the opportunities, the shadow, the stuff that you can't see. Be bloody impactful with it. Don't pussyfoot it. You know, and it's the same for both. Be as impactful as you can with what you're sharing with other people, from a place of love, not from a place of elevating yourself to make them feel small, but from a place of, I see something in you that I think it's really important you should know, be that an opportunity or be that something I just want you to keep doing.
What have you found to be the, or have you, you know, found any interesting cultural observations about remote companies as opposed to in-person companies?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what a change the world is going through. COVID hit, suddenly everybody's at home, you know, some of us aren't working, some of us are, and then, okay, now we've got to figure out how to keep being productive, because it's good for us as human beings, and it's good to keep the economy going and to keep the world going. And then that ends, and people go, well, now what? Do we go back to the office? Well, you know, I like my commute that takes me from my lounge to my office and takes about 30 seconds. Why do I want to get in a car and drive across LA?
I'm not wearing pants right now. This is great.
You know, I tend to wear a nice t-shirt, and then I've got, like, you know, my sweatpants on underneath. So, you know, there's a lot of benefits to being able to work remotely. However, there's a huge societal impact to it. And I've been working with a lot of startups on this, because I think it's going to be the biggest challenge of our generation, this and AI. And one of the things that we're discovering is there's got to be more play. There's got to be more humor. There's got to be more play. So something I can encourage everybody to do is every single meeting, start with some play. So be that 10 minutes of just chat and drop in and how are you, and tell me something fun that's going on in your life, or playing games. One of the calls I was on the other day, they have a habit in their team of showing each other what they got on their feet, which in remote working can be pretty fun, because people wear some weird stuff on their feet when they don't expect to get seen. So having some moment of connection at the beginning of meetings, so we don't just rush into, okay, what's the agenda, but we are connecting as human beings. Then there's got to be ways to get people together. So as a company, I think even the most remote of companies need to actually have some physical gatherings at some time. That for me is a huge worthwhile investment, however much it costs, to get together in person. And then us as individuals, we've got to take on, right, I'm not going to see people in person as much as before. How do I create that in my personal life? What am I doing? Am I going to go to a dance class? Am I going to go to yoga on the bluff in front of my here? You know, am I going to go to the gym every morning? What am I going to do to be around other people, and around other people in a way that I can actually talk to them and connect with them and have that human experience? You know, studies show that while we can feel connection with people on Zoom, like I feel connected to you now, I'm enjoying this experience, we don't release as much serotonin when that happens as we do when we touch somebody or we're close to somebody and we're in real life. So I think it's a company responsibility to create environments where that happens. And then it's a personal responsibility of, what am I doing to make sure I have community? And I know I've had to take that on. You know, one of the things I did was I retired from track cycling at the same time. So I lost a huge part of my community. I was going to the velodrome five times a week. I took up go-kart racing. So every other weekend, I was going and meeting 90 other people that were doing something that I liked, and I was spending 8 hours at the go-kart track with them. And that was filling up my social, you know, so not only was it filling up my need to be competitive, because if I'm not doing something competitive, the tyrant's more likely to come out than I need something competitive. But it was also filling up my social bucket. I was getting to hang around with people that were like me and also were different to me, you know, and my group that I would sit with, we had a huge variety of people with different political opinions, with different life experiences. And we hung out and we had something that we had in common and that we enjoyed being there for.
Mm. Yeah, I have this thing where whenever I get on a group Zoom call and start speaking, my first thought is, fuck, everyone hates me. That's my, and in a room, I'm like, we're high-fiving, chest bumping, we're having a... But my it's like a joke now. Like, reliably, yeah. If I'm presenting, my first thought is, everyone hates me. And I think... So here's a funny story. I had a guy on this podcast, super smart, like metacognitive thinker named Hunter Motz, and he was talking about human development and how good humans are at reading micro expressions and how much, oh, yeah. I'm sure you know a lot about this, how much what we are saying isn't actually coming out of our mouths. And he said, one thing you should really consider before getting plastic surgery is how much less you're going to be able to express your thoughts when your face is paralyzed. And I have the same thought where, like, if I'm on a Zoom call, it's like everyone has plastic surgery and I can't tell whether or not they love me or hate me. And it's a real thing, man, because when you're in person, you're communicating so much more than you are on a screen. And there's benefits and drawbacks to both. But yeah, I agree. I think that ensuring that if you are a remote company, you are making time for in-person play every now and again, it's going to reward the culture massively.
Yeah. You know, other things I think are important. Everybody has their video on. There's nothing worse than being on the Zoom where half the people don't have their videos on,
mm-hmm.
right? I would strongly encourage you have your video on. Be active in the chat. It's amazing how much more connected people feel when you're talking or you're giving a presentation or sharing something and people are responding in the chat with, like, I agree, or I have a question, or be interactive. Be as interactive as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Only have meetings that you need to have. I'm trying to think of who it was. Might have been, I think it was Adam Grant, was sharing about a study. And, you know, most of the meetings we have, they're longer than they need to be. They involve people that shouldn't be there. And they're set around a standard format of they're usually 30 minutes or an hour. Why?
Yeah.
You can have a meeting that's 8 minutes and it could be set as 8 minutes.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be 30 minutes. It tends to be the shortest meeting. So what he encouraged people to do was delete all of the meetings in your calendar and then start again and add back what you think needs to be added and is only vital. And then only invite people that need to be there and everybody else can get an email update.
Yeah. Yeah. Thinking about what you want to talk about before the meeting is also so massive. It's such a form of respect to the yes. other people in the meeting. And it can take 10 minutes before the meeting to just bullet yeah. point, hey, here's some things that I want to talk about, rather than just shooting fast and loose once you hit go on Zoom and you're like, okay, so what were we here to talk about? Yeah, those are some great best practices.
I'm a big fan of sending an agenda before every meeting.
Right.
You know, when I do my meetings with executive groups and director groups, I'll send out an email the day before. What is it you would like to get out of this meeting?
Mm.
So people are prepared before they come to the meeting. I'm getting them in the right headspace of, like, they're coming here to achieve something and to leave with something that's going to be beneficial to them. And they can send it to me beforehand, so I have an idea of how this meeting's going to go, the direction we might need to go, how much time I need to allot to different things.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about incorporating feedback. And I'll use myself as an example here. So here is one of my weaknesses, and people have given me this feedback. I know it about myself, and it's pretty often that the thing that you're best at is also the thing that you're worst at, right? And for me, it's I'm incredibly hard on myself. I'm a writer, so most of my career, I have put what I thought were my best ideas out to an editor, and their job is to tear me a fucking new one with murderous red lines through my entire document. Like, this was most of my 20s, and doing stand-up comedy, which is a group of editors not laughing at your jokes on stage again and again and again. It's bee stings, right? Like, you get off stage the first time and you think you're going to throw up, right? Or there's a wonderful editor, one of the best I've ever worked with, named Elizabeth Lombach, who said most new writers I work with would send a draft of an article that they wanted to write. And they're like, you know, these new wet behind the ears writers, like, I want to be a writer. And she would read it, give really thoughtful edits, send it back, and she'd never hear from them again. Because they just, you know, it just, their egos crumble, right? But that's the world that I live in. And I want to become a world-class writer. And to do that, it takes being very blunt and very honest about which ideas are good and which ideas are bad. There's just no room for fluff if you actually want to be good. So that's the way that I talk to myself. I do think also that I've gotten quite a bit better at, like, being kind to myself in certain instances and then needing to be brutally honest with myself in instances. I love feedback. I love hard feedback. And then I give hard feedback. And I've had the feedback. People have told me that I can be intimidating and a little harsh and mean. They perceive it as mean when I'm giving them feedback. And for me, it's just like, do you want to be good or not? Like, that's, yeah. And as you might imagine, that thought doesn't land very well with people who I'm working with. So it's something that I've heard from others, and I find myself still struggling to incorporate the feedback. So how would you keep someone like me accountable to continuing to work on that? Because it might be that this is a tendency of mine that makes me not a good fit for the culture. If it's just a bunch of rainbows and butterflies and we're just going to, fluff each other up kind of culture, like, I probably shouldn't be here. And I should probably be at a place that's a bit more blunt in service of the best work. But it's something that I do want to work on, right? How would you ensure someone like me just continue to keep that feedback front and center week after week, month after month, and not forget about it? Like, how would you ensure that progress is actually being made for an employee at a company that you're working with?
Well, you've done the first bit. You've done the first hard work, Carl, which is you have some awareness about yourself and you are taking this feedback on board. So that's the first part of it, is right. Who am I and how am I impacting other people? And then what am I going to do with it? The framework I love to think about this is, do I want to be right or do I want to be impactful? Do I want to be right or do I want to be effective? And, you know, my wife would say, do you want to be right or do you want to be kind? And it never quite gelled with me because, yes, I do want to be kind.
You're right.
You know, fuck, I want to be right.
I want you to be better. Right. Be better. Be better.
There's nothing in the world I like more than being right. Okay. Yeah. I am obnoxious about it.
Man after my own heart, Lee.
And you know what? I'm really, really smart. So I often am. However, it can make me really, really ineffective with people. So, you know, one of the big shifts with me was realizing I don't want to be right for the sake of being right. I want to be effective. So that means I have to adapt myself to the people I'm with. And I think this is the greatest quality any leader can have. And when I say leader, I'm talking about human beings that want to be part of a system. You are a leader in some way. You're a leader of yourself. You're a leader of, you're part of the system. It's not just the CEO or the founders that are leaders. We are all leaders. And you see this a lot in sports teams, right? You have a captain of the team and other people displaying leadership. So I think it's, how can I be adaptive to be my most effective? So how do I give feedback to the person in front of me in such a way that they are going to be able to receive it? And if I expect the entire world to always think like me, behave like me, and receive feedback like me, what's going to happen?
I'm going to be lonely.
And you're going to be disappointed and you're going to be like angry, and you're going to feel like you're wrong.
Yeah.
So,
and like you're not being heard, you know, you're going to feel frustrated that the world isn't going your way. Yeah. Right. Like I think that ultimately is what happens, is that you just continue to hit, when you can't adapt, you continue to hit your head up against the wall again and again and again, and ultimately become old and resentful. And it happens to a lot of people.
Angry old man showing at the cloud meme, right?
Yeah.
So there's two things. One, the first part is that, how can you adapt to be your most effective self? And I really like that, because it gives me agency, right? I am adapting and figuring out, using my brain, using my smarts, to be really effective here. And I have to understand the other person to be effective. So I like that. And then the other thing is, just find your peers, right? You know, don't be around people that don't want to work at the level that you want to work at. I experienced this as a cycling coach. I would invite other coaches in when I was doing national team training sessions. And there were some that would come in and they loved it. And they're like, oh, wow, this is great. And oh, see how you're doing things differently. And we'd end the session and I would say to every coach, how could we have done that better? How could I have been a better coach today? So I'm modeling that I'm open to the feedback. And then we get some coaches that come in and they would argue about everything and they would never receive feedback themselves. And you just let those people go. They are not your people. You want to be searching out people that are hungry for the feedback. And you want to be holding both these positions at the same time. I want to find people that are my people. And I want to be more effective so I can work with more people. Mm. Because the best leaders can adapt themselves to a wide range of people. And, you know, it used to be popular to say, well, what's your leadership style? And there'd be all these different types, authoritarian and open and kind and, you know, collaborative. What about just being all of them? Mm. What about just adapting yourself to the person in front of you and thinking, how do I get the best out of this person or this situation, while searching for, where am I a best fit?
Mm.
Where am I closest to it? So it's not like I have to completely change my being and, you know, dress in pink the whole time, sir, and wear a blonde wig so that everybody loves me. Like, how can I show up as authentic Kyle? And then how can I change my delivery so that I'm the most effective version of me? I think that's where the gold is. If you can hold both of those, where you strive for the excellence and you strive for what you want and you strive for the people that are going to give you the feedback you're looking for, while remembering there's other human beings here and I have to figure out how to be effective with them and in relationship with them.
At the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned, I believe, that your mom worked with homeless people, homeless kids.
No, it was, I guess some of them you would class as that, but it was, foster kids.
Foster kids. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about your experience witnessing that and what it taught you about humans.
Firstly, I have so much admiration for my mum and my auntie. So, you know, the very short story is my dad was an arsehole. My auntie lived with us. They kicked my dad out. So it was my mum, my auntie, me, my brother, and my sister. And my dad took all the money. We had no money. My mom was very brave, tried to be an entrepreneur. None of it worked. And it coincided with a really big depression in the late 80s in the UK. And we lost our house. So I was 17, 18 years old. My little brother was 14. And we lost our house. We got evicted. My mum's best friend said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to buy you a house. You're going to go to university, get a degree. And, you know, you and Sally, my auntie, you're going to foster kids to afford this. This is what we're going to do. So at 50 years old, or just before 50, my mum went to university. She did a degree in accountancy and law. They loved her so much that they kept her on after she graduated, and she became a lecturer. So for the last 15 years of her life, she was a university lecturer. And I just have so much admiration for her and for Sally, for what they did and how they turned their lives around. At the time I was a real estate agent, we bought and sold a bunch of property to the point that my mom was able to retire in Cyprus with no mortgage, you know, buy property outright, and, you know, is now living a pretty comfortable life there. And what I then observed with these kids was, it doesn't take a lot to have a huge impact. You know, my mum wasn't very fluffy. She's not a very, oh, you're wonderful and everything's amazing. But what she was incredibly consistent. Breakfast was the same time every day. Dinner was the same time every day. And she cared, and she was there, and she would talk to them, and she would ask them how they're doing. And almost always they would rebel to begin with because they just couldn't handle it. They just didn't know how to handle that kind of consistency, because most of them never had that. They didn't have consistency. Their parents were all over the place. Their parents might be overtly loving, telling them how great they were, but weren't there and didn't care. And then you'd see them both emotionally and physically flourish. Almost every kid grew rapidly when they came, because they were getting fed regularly and because they were getting emotional care. And they were part of a family. And my mom worked with the highest risk cases. And most of them turned out as well as they could have from that experience with her. You know, the longest she had somebody was a year. Most of them were a few weeks. And she set them up to be ready to move into longer term foster care. And just the resilience that she had to do that, and how being consistent is such a huge part of it. I've started following this guy called Alex Hormozi. I don't know if you've come across him.
Yeah, did he write $100 million deals?
That's him.
Yeah.
And, you know, he talks about this a lot. It just, there's so much value to consistency. And as humans, we tend to think things have happened quickly, because what happens is the people that are doing well, they kind of just pop up out of nowhere. And it's like, you know, who's this person? They're doing well. They're talking about something interesting. I've never heard of them before. Well, what we've missed is all the failure that they had before it, and how being consistent and keeping being consistent is so important. And it's exactly the same in relationships. And, you know, watching these young adults and adolescents just get consistency. And my mum would be like, dinner's at 6 o'clock. And if you're not home at 6 o'clock, you're not getting dinner. And they'd rebel against it. And then pretty quickly they'd be home at 6 o'clock. And then suddenly it'd be like they were looking forward to being home at 6 o'clock, because they could sit around a table and actually engage with whoever else was in the house, the other foster kids, and my mum and Sally, and they'd be heard and they'd be appreciated and they'd be acknowledged. And she wasn't, you know, she wasn't working miracles. And I mean that as in, like, she wasn't doing anything like particularly creative or inventive or magical. She just cared, and she provided the basics, and that goes such a long way.
Damn good answer right there. What is a habit in your life that used to be really hard, habit or quality about yourself that used to be really hard and now is almost thoughtless due to consistency?
Exercising by myself.
Mm. Tell me about that. And how did you get it? How did you get that going?
Yeah. I like winning. I don't like exercising. So, you know, I would train.
That's like, that's like they
win.
Say, I don't like writing. I like having written.
So, you know, I wanted to win bike races. And as a byproduct of wanting to win bike races, I had to do training. So what I would initially, you know, how I worked around my own psychology was I'd create training groups. The reason I initially became a cycling coach is because I didn't want to train by myself. So I invited other people to train with me. And then they started saying, well, what are we going to do today? I'm like, I don't know. So I would start researching physiology and then bring in ideas and speaking to other coaches and go, okay, well, let's try this. So I de facto became the coach for our group before I officially moved into coaching. And then in 2010, and me and you have spoken about this offline, I broke my shoulder. And there's been lots that have come from that period because it was a pretty difficult period for me. One of the things that came from it was realizing that exercising was a privilege. When I couldn't exercise, you know, at one point I just couldn't use my left arm. It was so damaged. It made me realize that exercise is a privilege. And I fell more in love with exercising for the sake of exercising and enjoying how it felt and enjoying how my body felt. And I also moved much more to being about the process than winning. So everything became about process. How can I be the best version of myself? Other things that have really helped me is I like rules and I like making global decisions. So if I was, you know, if I was a national team coach now, I wouldn't train the way that I train now personally, or I wouldn't train my athletes, because what I would do is look at how well recovered are you today? What exercise can you do depending on your level of recovery? Which, if you are looking at elite athletes, is absolutely the way to do it. What are you recovered enough to do today? And we will keep adapting the program. However, if you're not looking to compete in the Olympics, that's a really challenging way to train. What's much more effective is I go to the gym at 8:30, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday, every week regardless. That's it. And I go and train, and I train until around 9:30, 10 o'clock, depending on what I'm doing that day. I write my training program in advance. I write out what I'm going to do for a block. So I just go there and do it. I don't have to think about it. I might adapt it on the day if I'm, you know, got some soreness or I'm not feeling great. Unless I'm absolutely on my deathbed, I will go and do some exercise. So even if I just go and do 5 minutes on the elliptical and some stretching, I will make myself go to the gym so that that routine is being carried out. And therefore, I don't have to think about it. And then, you know, to make it even easier, I prepare my gym stuff the night before. So, you know, me and my wife get up, I eat my breakfast, we go to the dog park, let the dog run around and terrorize other dogs. Then we come back, I go straight to the gym. There's no thought involved in it. That is my routine.
Hear, hear. Hear, hear. Yeah, I think scaling down your goals to the lowest, to the minimum sufficient possible application is such a profound concept to overcome burnout. And it's like, you know, consistency beats intensity. And I do that with writing, man. I mean, I would say that the most powerful concept I've learned in this past year is with this little thing that I'm holding up in front of the screen right now. It's called the Time Timer. You can get it on Amazon for $30. It's just basically a little cooking timer. And I keep it in front of my computer and I crank this thing to whether it's 30 minutes or an hour. And the overwhelming task of trying to write a book suddenly gets condensed down into a 30-minute or 1 hour period. And the ability to take something that is that big and that overwhelming and that paralyzing down into, okay, I'm just going to write this one little scene over the next hour, makes it possible. And it makes it fun. And then you can, often then I'll go more than an hour, or I'll take a little walk around the block and then I'll do another hour. But yeah, it really is the key to success, man. I mean, it's like, I don't care who you are. It's just about making these smaller chunks and these smaller circles.
Learn to enjoy the process.
Yeah.
So make the process something that you enjoy just for itself. And then the result will take care of itself. And that goes right to the highest levels of entrepreneurship and elite sport.
Mm-hmm.
Like, learn to enjoy the training you're doing. Learn to enjoy the work you do. keep it consistent. I love that, you know, I think this is so important for people like you and writers. Just write 30 minutes a day. Don't give yourself any pressure about what it is or how many words you have to do. Just say, I'm just going to write for 30 minutes. If you write three words, that's still three words is better than nothing. Mm-hmm. So give myself 30 minutes a day, I'm going to write. And if I want to write a bit more because I'm really in it, great. Mm. And if I don't, well, I sat here for 30 minutes and I wrote something. Consistency is so key. We as humans are very good at overestimating what we can do in a short space of time. Like, I'm going to lose 30 pounds in 3 weeks. No, you're not, unless you completely stop eating, right? You're just not. However, if you eat 500 calories a day less than you need to eat, and then, you know, then your output over a week, you're going to lose a pound. Over 50 weeks, you're going to lose 50 pounds. And remembering that and focusing on those small gains has huge impact over time. You know, going to the gym, if I want to improve my squat by 50 pounds, I can try to do that in 3 weeks, or I can say, why don't I just add 2.5 pounds a week? 25 weeks, I've gone up 50 pounds. 25 weeks is not that long in the scheme of things. So I think we're just in a rush, and taking the rush away and instead going for consistent improvements and gains has a much, much bigger impact long term.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to touch on one thing you said right there, which is getting into this space of enjoying the process. Working with founders, working with these, you know, high profile startups, I think Elon Musk had this quote where he's like, being a founder is like chewing on glass and staring into the abyss, because you're working on, the founders are working on the hardest problems by nature of their job. The founder and the CEO are given the hardest problems. And it can feel, I mean, I've never been a founder or CEO, so I can't speak to this, but it could be very easy, I would imagine, to get in a state where you just want to give up and not do this thing that's so goddamn hard anymore. How do you, and it, maybe it's just as simple as reminding them of this concept, but along with the concept of compound interest and these incremental gains as being one of the most powerful I've ever stumbled upon, the idea of just getting into what you were talking about when you were recovering from your bike accident, where you think to yourself, oh, I get to do this, is right up there with one and two. Like when I switch from, oh, I have to write today, to, whoa, I get to write today. That's amazing. That is amazing. It's like all of a sudden the wind switches and it's at my heels, right? How do you, or do you talk to teams that you work with about this very simple but very profound concept of gratitude?
Yeah, I love that. And it's poignant because I had a coaching session with one of my founders yesterday, and they have had a big switch around this, where they went from that burden of, I've got to do this, you know, I started a company, I have to do this, to, I get to do this. I get to learn how to be a leader. I get to learn how to run a company. And a part of the big switch for them was realizing that it didn't matter whether this company failed or succeeded. And instead, they were going to focus on enjoying the process, and they were going to focus on being better versions of themselves. And then the result will take care of itself, which is exactly the approach I took with elite athletes. People sit there and go, I want to win stuff, right? Or I want to win the Olympics. Great. How?
Yeah. You can't. Everyone wants to, right? That's the point, is everyone wants to win the Olympics.
But you just can't just win it. It's a whole number of things that are going to have to happen for you to eventually get there. And, you know, I one of the things I do as well is I coach elite sports coaches. So I coached the Dutch national team coaches, athletes, won 3 gold medals at the last Olympics and a silver medal. And, you know, the big thing that we worked on, you know, for him personally, was him enjoying his job. His goal at the Olympics was to go to the Olympics and enjoy the experience as much as possible. We had a 15-minute check-in every morning where he would, like, you know, just vent whatever was going on for him, get his head clear, and then go to the velodrome to enjoy it, because he knew his athletes were in great shape and he trusted what will happen will happen. There wasn't a lot he could do at that point, right? Apart from be there and share the experience with them. And yeah, sure, you know, share some tactical knowledge and GM up when he needed to and calm him down when he needed to. But 99% of it was done. They were either in the shape to win the Olympics or they weren't. Mm. You can't make somebody in the shape on the day. They're either ready or they're not. So it's that realization of this process is what actually matters. And when you get there, the result will take care of itself. You know, if you become the best leader you can be and you are doing the best you can for your company, it will work or it won't work. But the desire for it to work isn't going to change the outcome. What will change the outcome is focusing on what you actually take control of. How did you show up as a leader today? How did that meeting go? How did that presentation go? Do you have a culture, as we were talking about earlier, of giving each other the feedback needed for the company to keep elevating? Or do we have a culture we don't want to upset everybody? Mm. Well, if we have that culture, we're not going to succeed. So I think it's really having the wherewithal to look at yourself and say, what is it I need to focus on? How can I be excellent at the things I do? How can I lean in and have gratitude and enjoy it and realize how lucky I am? You know, how many people get to start a company? Not many. I've started 6 companies. I've sold 2 companies. 2 companies have failed and I've got 2 companies going right now. And I'm thankful for all of it. I'm thankful for the ones that failed because I learned something from it. I'm thankful for the ones that worked, but I ended up hating them and selling them, because I've learned something from it. And I think having that curiosity of what am I learning today and how can I transfer that to being a better version of me tomorrow? How can I transfer that to being a better leader? How can I have better relationships with the people I work with? And knowing that better relationships isn't how can I make people like me more? It's how can I bring more to this? How can I be more effective? How can I support them more? How can I mentor them more to be the best versions of themselves? And I think that's where you find gratitude.
Hear, hear. Last thing I wanted to ask you about in this wide-ranging and very fun conversation, and it goes back to this idea of somatic learning, what's happening in your body when you are doing the thing. And you can take this answer wherever you want, whether you want to go from sports to leadership coaching. But I was listening to one of my favorite writers named Michael Lewis. He wrote Moneyball, he wrote The Big Short, and he's a big sports guy. He has a podcast called Against the Rules, and each season covers a different subject, but there was one season on coaching. And he spoke with a guy who, I'm sorry I forget the name, but he wrote a book called The Inner Game of Tennis. And what he found through this book, it applies to much more than just tennis, that when he was explaining less to the players, they were doing better. So rather than giving them these specific techniques, he just asked them to basically feel what it feels like to hit a really great shot somatically overall. And by explaining less, but doing more of just like, okay, how does it feel to be in that zone? They were immediately playing better. And he tells this story of applying this same technique to sports that he knew nothing about, or activities that he knew nothing about. And he went to an orchestra. And there was a tuba player who was having a hard time hitting this one note. So the coach said, well, what does it feel like when you are able to hit that note? And the tuba player said, my tongue is wet when I am able to hit this note. Like I noticed that inside my mouth. And when I have a hard time playing it, my tongue is dry. So the coach said, all right, well, rather than focus on anything else, I just want you to keep the tongue wet. Just focus on keeping the tongue wet. And the tuba player belts out this great sound and the whole orchestra gives him an applause. And the funny thing is the coach was like, I couldn't tell the difference between the notes. Like for me, it was just all tuba. But I've thought about that more and more, that like there is technique for sure, but our bodies kind of have this wisdom that can click us into being able to operate at a very high level if we simply somatically get into this space of feeling what it feels like to do it well. And I was wondering if you have any experience with that, and if you teach it at all, given your history in cycling and now executive coaching.
Okay, I'm going to approach this in two ways. First way is a very quick bit of teaching about how we learn. So when we're learning new skills, the first stage we go through is unconsciously incompetent. We don't know how to do it. We don't know what it is. We're trying to do this thing. It feels really weird. We have no idea what's going on. The next stage is consciously incompetent. So now we have an idea of what we want to do, but we still can't really do it. Then we move to consciously competent. So now we understand what we're trying to do and we can evaluate it and have an idea, but there's still a lot of cognitive processing going on. It's tiring and we're not doing it as quickly as we would like to do. Then we move to unconsciously competent. We're not thinking about it. You know, this is how most people are driving around, for example. You're not spending a lot of time thinking, how do I turn a steering wheel? It's just happening. It's now an automated process. And then we move to mastery. And what we often see with leadership coaches like me, or, you know, I like to think of myself as a high performance coach. My job is to get the most performance from somebody and to help them get the most performance from themselves, is adapting ourselves to the level that somebody is at. You know, when I'm working with a new leader, there might be a stage where we're just going over the fundamentals of what is leadership. And without some good framework and fundamentals, there's no kind of starting point. However, that relationship must evolve to the point where I'm not teaching you anymore. I'm not trying to teach you how to fish. I am supporting you as you self-evaluate yourself, as you learn more about what's going on, and you can course correct. And this is exactly the same for athletes. You know, as my relationship improves with my athletes, once we've gone past the fundamentals of, like, you know, how do you do this thing? How do you ride a bike sprint race? Or how do you do a standing start, right? The fundamentals of what is it? Once you've moved past that, they have to be able to understand it themselves. And ideally, they should be able to understand it as well, if not better than I can. And certainly understand themselves as well, if not better than I can. And I can release all ego that I have to be smarter than you. I have to understand it more than you. You know, think of it as the, are you going to feed somebody fish or are you going to teach them to fish? I teach people to fish. I don't feed them. And then they teach other people to fish. And then I hold their hands and congratulate them on doing it. So it's that concept of how these things evolve. And I completely agree. You know, when things are going as you want them to go, you know, you walk out of a meeting and you go, yeah, that just worked. And then you try to go, okay, why? Why do I feel like this? Why is my tongue wet? Or, you know, like, what is it about this? Oh, my tongue's wet. Right. How do I replicate that? And that's where I think I'm useful. People come out and they talk to me and they share, and then I can see and reflect those things just like that guy did. So he's hearing the information. He's going, oh, so it's when your tongue's wet. Okay, so just focus on that. I'm not telling you to do that. I'm hearing what you're saying. I'm getting all the fluff out of the way and repeating to you the stuff that really matters so you can keep doing it and keep growing. You know, coming back to that coach I worked with at the Olympics, he knew his athletes already. His job is not to tell them what to do. His job is to stand there so that they know that there's somebody in their corner that supports them. Because when they get on the track and they're in the race, there's nothing he can do. He can't tell them. He doesn't have a headset. Can't say to them in a moment, go left, go right, make your move now. They have to decide that. So you want somebody to be able to do that and do it instinctively and know what it feels like and feel the right thing to do in the moment. And that comes from a lot of trust. That comes from me trusting that the people I work with are going to be okay. And they're going to be okay whether they fail or not, right? They're going to learn from it and they're going to be okay. And they're going to be okay if their company doesn't fail, because they're going to learn from it. And we're going to take that to the next company, and then that is going to work. You look at almost every successful entrepreneur, and have had as many failures as successes. Their successes just happen to make a lot of money. And that's why we know about them.
Yeah.
Right? Richard Branson, first five companies went bankrupt, whatever it was. You know, now the guy's a billionaire. And even some of his big things have gone bankrupt, right? You know, he's just been brave and tried it and learned from it. Oh, what do I learn from this and take it to the next thing? But yeah, I love that concept of it needs to be subconscious. And then you want to bring it to the conscious so that you can keep crafting it. And then you want to tap it back into the subconscious. So that is that switching between consciously competent in our learning phase, and then back into subconscious and then mastery. Mm. And whenever you adjust something or learn something new, you can go back to any stage in the learning process, including unconsciously incompetent. You know, Tiger Woods relearns how to swing a club, because he's like, how I do it right now is going to be limiting. And he does this after he's won the Masters by 19 strokes or something stupid. Like, he's won the Masters with the biggest winning margin in history. And he goes, that's not going to be enough. That's not going to make me the best golfer who's ever lived. You know, that's bravery. And the first time you go and try a different swing, you're like, what the hell is going on? This feels so weird. I can't understand it. The best people understand that's just part of the process, and you will move out of that. Did that answer it?
Absolutely. Lee Pavi, I am such a fan of what you do. You bring so much value to the world with your clarity of thought, and this was just an absolute blast. Where can people find you, get in touch, learn more about what you do?
Yeah, I'm going for a big rebrand at the moment. So if you just Google me, Lee Pavi, you will find me on social media. You find my website. Email me, lee@mypcoaching.org. I want to speak to anybody. Like, if you work in a startup, if you're a founder, if you're an elite sports coach, I want to help you get whatever it is that you want to get. My personal desire is to make an impact on the world. I'm not a politician. I would make a very poor politician. So my way of making an impact is helping the smartest, most brilliant people I can find make their impact for the positive of humanity.
Hear, hear. Thank you so much, my friend. This was an absolute blast.
My pleasure, Carl. And may I thank you for your really thoughtful questions. They were fun.
That's what we do here. That's what we do. Next time we'll do it in person. I thought you hated me the whole time. I was just like, oh my God, this guy. Either he's got plastic surgery or he hates me. I can't tell which, but I feel judged. No, seriously, man, this was an absolute blast.
If we're going to talk about a rule, one rule should be nobody's allowed filters on Zoom.
Mm.
I meant to say that earlier, because it does, right? You can't see people's expressions.
Yeah, no more anime filters. Done with that. All right, buddy, this was so much fun. We'll have to do it again sometime. Bye.
I appreciate you.
Boom. That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you. Lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.